Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting journalist Susanna Cahalan to analyse the complex history of psychiatry.
Then we'll be donning our branded sportswear and heading to the terraces with photographer Martin Anderson.
And reports of paintings' death are greatly exaggerated. We'll catch up with artist Ryan Mosley to unpack a new exhibition that puts paid to one of the art world's biggest clichés.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today, and we'll enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Tom, nice to see you on this sunny Sunday.
I wish I could say the same, Org. No, I jest, of course. Great to be back in the Monocle Weekly.
I know, it's your favourite place to be, isn't it?
I love my Sunday lunch radio adventure that
your
we go
weekly
on.
Sunday roast.
Listen, the people you meet on this show, you never quite know. It's like, you know those challenges? Who would be invited to your fantasy dinner party? Anyone you want, alive or dead. I feel a bit like that's how the Monocle Weekly works. What a lineup we've got today. I can't wait to break metaphorical bread with them in the coming hour.
Yeah, it'll be fun, won't it? What have you been doing over the past 7 days? Did you follow the Oscars?
I did. We'll perhaps come to that in a moment. I know our colleague, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, I don't think he slept for about 48 hours as he followed the parasitic triumph in every lurid detail. I must admit, I slept through it.
That's only 20% less sleep than he normally gets.
This is a fair point. We'll have to put that to him. Let's talk to Fernando and find out how much sleep he did have on Oscars night. Let's call him in. There was something. Fernando, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Before we get into what's happening next week, the past 7 days, I believe you had 0 hours sleep on Oscar night. Is that correct?
And can I be honest, I was not tired because usually the Oscars, they do that to me. They give me such a buzz that I think it lasts for quite a few days, I have to say.
Well, is that in the 4 or 5 tins of sugar-free Red Bull you drink
exactly.
from a plastic straw?
Exactly.
Other stimulants are available.
You know, I can even, I think for next year, I will prepare like a special Oscar menu, you know, champagne, cheese, and yes, at the end of the party, sugar-free Red Bull
just
as well.
Just to pep you up. But listen, I know we should move on, but you must have been delighted. Parasites, triumph, history making. I know you're a fan of the film.
So happy. I mean, finally, my favorite film win for Best Picture. That doesn't happen very often. I mean, there were some problems in the ceremony. I even wrote something on the minute. It was the least watched ever. I mean, it was a bit clunky. I think they should do a little bit more fun, the ceremony. But I did like who they chose in the end. And that's the most important thing.
Controversially, I actually think it was the wrong decision. I went to see Parasite on Monday last and enjoyed it. But there was no way that I was thinking about it as much as I thought about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which stuck with me for a couple of weeks.
Fernando, would you like to counter this?
You know what? I disagree mildly, but I have to say Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is not a bad film.
It's not a bad film.
I think it was a work of passion by Quentin Tarantino. Having said that, I'm glad Parasite won.
What's in the news coming up this week, Faye, before we come to blows?
Exactly. A lovely week, actually. We start with very good news from Brazil. Friday's Carnival. It's kind of, I say, very good news. I mean, we're such a state. But that's the thing about Brazilians. I mean, no matter the situation of the country, people still enjoy Carnival. And I have to say, I've never been such a big fan of Carnival when I was in Brazil. But then I was there in January in Rio, and they were celebrating already because the city mayor, he said, let's do 50 days of Carnival. So they've been celebrating since early
50
January.
50 days?
50 days.
So that's bacchanalian.
Can there be too much Carnival?
Not for
Brazilians.
Seemingly not. And actually, even in São Paulo, there's been street blocks already happening. It's something called the pre-carnival. But Brazilians love that. And I'm sure they'll invent the post-carnival parties. It's never ending.
I think 50 days is actually longer than Lent, the period of fasting meant to lead up to, isn't it?
Have that, Christianity.
Exactly.
That's very exciting. And we'll be charting, presumably, some of the goings-on at Carnival.
And the hits of Carnival
ahead.
As well.
Absolutely. What else has caught your eye?
Saturday. The next day, another very important event in Paris is the Salon d'Agriculture. I hope my French accent was okay.
Oui, oui.
I mean, it's the biggest kind of farming event in the world. And I mean, I always, you know, we always mention the event every year because they choose their mascot cow.
That's right.
That's the one, right?
So have you got last year's winner? We've run through these before.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to know who is the mascot cow this year?
Yeah, go on.
Her name is Ideal. I mean, which means the ideal one. And she's 6 years old. She's from the breed Charolais, which
Of course.
I think it's the most important one in France.
A very beautiful bovine.
Exactly. I mean, and some descriptions here, which makes a beautiful cow, according to the salon, is short head, a broad muzzle, and nice sharp teeth. Oh. I never thought about cow's teeth before. I mean, do you think they bite?
What's the prize for being the mascot cow? Do you get slaughtered and turned into Andouillette for Macron himself?
They do a lot of press during the event. I've seen this before. They're a bit of a celebrity.
Absolutely.
And then they're put in a big baguette, I guess.
And I think, whoever, I don't want to say owns the cow, whoever. I mean, gets very popular as well, his farm, potential
And what
farm.
Else have we got there? Have we got a lot of tractors and combine harvesters and corn and all this
Literally
kind of thing?
Everything related
it's
to farming.
Exciting, isn't it?
I like the animals bits because, you know, they have a lot of horses and pigs, so probably I would be sticking around.
Are you sure that's not just the food court?
That could be it as well. Good meat, I'm sure.
Fernando, time for one more.
On Thursday, Monocle's new issue is coming out next week. And may I say, it's going to be a special in Austria, right? So it's the day, the 20th of February, is the day of the Viennese Opera Ball, which is, you know, one of the most important events in the city, where there's about 5,000 people. You know, you pay, you know, quite a lot, I have to say, to see, you know, 150 young couples dancing their first Polonaise. And I think it's a beautiful event. There'll be celebrities. You can talk to some Austrian politicians, if you may like, as well.
Nice. Sebastian Kurz. Well, yeah. Pleasure. What's your favourite thing about Austria, Faye?
Well, I do like the food.
I was going to jump straight in and just say it's got to be schnitzel.
Yeah, schnitzel. And Wolfram as well, the Austrian DJ, which I had the pleasure to meet for the issue as well. So they do some good, you know, electro as well.
Can you think of anything beyond a crumbed breaded cutlet?
Once someone mentioned schnitzel, I can't even focus. I may have to leave and go around to Fischer's right now.
Schnitzel's in a twist. Yeah.
And you should drink Almdudler with it. It's their soft drink. Delicious.
Get your lips around a doodler.
Don't mind if I do.
For real satisfaction in the week ahead. Fernando, always good to hear from you. You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. In a moment, we'll be hearing about a landmark experiment that supposedly put the lie to psychiatry.
Susanna Cahalan is a journalist with direct experience of the American mental health system. In her 20s, a rare brain infection was very nearly misdiagnosed as schizoaffective disorder. Her incarceration in an institution was only prevented by her talented neurologist, who was able to treat the infection.
Those experiences resulted in her first book, Brain on Fire, but her interest in the institutional mechanics of how society treats the mentally unwell have persisted. Her latest work, The Great Pretender, uses a controversial experiment into the efficacy of asylums to unpack the complicated history of society's relationship with mental ill health. Earlier, Augustine caught up with Susanna to find out more.
On first reading this study called On Being Sane in Insane Places by Stanford professor of psychology, David Rosenhan, is exceptional in that it's like such an amazing read. The premise of the study was that he and seven other volunteers, people he called pseudo patients, went undercover in psychiatric hospitals around the United States. And all that they did was they said, I hear a voice that says, thud, empty, hollow. Just that presentation. Everything else in their life would remain intact. You know, any issues with their mother or problems with parenting or job issues, all those things would remain intact. The only things that they would change would be kind of slight biographical details to preserve their identities. But otherwise, it would maintain this, be the same as their own personal histories. And so they wanted to test to see, would these institutions be able to ferret out sanity from insanity, as he put it? The results were damning. All of the eight pseudo patients were misdiagnosed based, again, on that one symptom with serious mental illness in almost every case but one. It was with schizophrenia, and that other case was with manic depression, which is now known as bipolar disorder. What happened was, once they were given these labels, everything they did in that hospital setting became further proof of their diagnosis. So there are kind of incredible details littered throughout that 8-page paper that was published in Science. At one point, someone is pacing outside of a cafeteria, and one of the attendants comes up and says, nerves? And the response was, you know, no, I'm just bored. But everything they did within the context of the asylum became further proof of their mental illness. The ramifications of that study, the kind of outcome was enormous, really. You can't really underestimate it.
It's as though everyone went into these institutions and what they brought with them was this incredible degree of confirmation bias, like they were pregnant with the possibility for madness, and that this study set out to expose that in an institution is what people are looking for.
You know, that's beautifully put. Confirmation bias is key. You know, there are many things that are taken away from this study. And I think the thing that was the most damning on the superficial level was the misdiagnosis. But I think what you hit on, which was this confirmation bias, this idea that we are all, including doctors, are primed to see the world in certain ways. And our bias inflects what we see. In one example, there was each of the pseudo patients were writing, and they wrote about their stays to kind of chronicle what was happening. And that actually showed up in their medical records as being signs of their psychosis, signs of their mental illness, what was described as writing behavior. Basically, you had the staff, once you were hospitalized, they saw you through the prism of your diagnosis. And I think to me, that is one of the most fascinating takeaways of that paper.
Now, you obviously have a very, very developed professional interest in this field. Otherwise, you wouldn't have produced such a kind of robustly researched and carefully written book. But you also have a personal interest, don't you?
Yes, I do. You know, this book absolutely would not have come about without my own experience with psychosis. And it informs every page of the book. And I come with my own set of confirmation bias as well, because in many ways, I entered this narrative feeling very wronged by psychiatry in a lot of ways.
What I find interesting about the narrative is that one of the things that it kind of explores is this idea that perhaps unlike other illnesses, there's a cultural dimension to the way that we relate to mental illness. I'm interested to hear your reflections on the way that society's relationship to that kind of incapacitation, which isn't just clearly physical, where there's a malaise that could be treated, but which is something ephemeral, how it's changed.
It's an amazing story, which, you know, before I went into this narrative, I thought that it would be a kind of clear path of progress, you know, a kind of linear path of progress, which I had mistakenly assumed that all of medicine followed, which is not the truth. We go forward and we go backward. But what's interesting to me is that when psychiatry first came into being, which was in, you know, the 19th century, when psychiatry, the term, actually entered the parlance, it actually started in a very biological way. People were searching for treatments of the brain or the body in terms of treating, quote unquote, mental illness. And some of these pursuits went into extremely dark places. There were things like spinning chairs that would induce vertigo to such an extreme degree that you would evacuate your bowels and throw up. And that was supposed to be, you're trying to have an emetic for madness. There were people who believed that madness was caused by infection. And so there was one doctor in particular in America, it was Dr. Cotton, who believed that if you remove teeth, that you would remove the source of the infection. What would happen was when he removed all the teeth and the madness still remained, he would start to remove organs as well until the patient died. So you had these kind of egregious acts against the body to try to treat the mind. And then you kind of had a backlash against that with Freud. And at that point, it went to the other side of the pendulum. And what you notice in the history of psychiatry, and again, in the history of medicine, I think it's fair to say, you see these pendulums swinging, and they swing so far. They go to such extremes. And so when Freud, especially in America, I mean, Americans really took to Freud more than British, and we really embraced this idea that we could heal the self, heal the ego, this idea that it was not the body, it was the mind. That was really exciting, especially after World War I and II, when you had a lot of PTSD in soldiers. So it's this interesting moments where these pendulums swung back and forth. And so then when you come to Rosenhan's era, we're emerging from that Freud stupor. And I think a lot of medicine really started to believe that psychiatry wasn't a legitimate branch of medicine. And so you have this moment in American psychiatry where it was having a bit of an identity crisis. And then here comes this study, and it just blew the whole thing wide open and seemed to prove that psychiatry didn't know what the hell it was doing.
Now, you kind of touched on it there, and I understand that the history of medicine is really littered with incredibly kind of egregiously violent and objectively, from our perspective, objectively bad ideas in terms of treatment. But it seems like, for want of a better term, what has throughout history been labelled as madness, patients with that have been singled out for particularly sadistic treatment. You just mentioned some of those. I wondered what you think it is in the treatment in madness that kind of inspires such a sort of visceral response on the part of society that legitimizes sufferers as victims of treatment that you would never even administer to kind of prisoners.
You know, I think that is a beautiful question, and it's one that I asked myself repeatedly throughout the course of writing this book, and I don't think there's a simple answer. I have my own theories, and I can't say that they are accurate, but the way I feel about it is that there are certain levels of detachment that you can have when you're dealing with someone who doesn't share your reality, and I think that that detachment can enable some bad behavior. You can almost other the person to the point where they're not human. And I think that you see that a lot in the history of psychiatry, where someone who is raving, someone who's psychotic, they are so outside of your normal kind of experience of the world or shared reality that you don't necessarily afford them the kind of level of humanity that you would someone who is having a heart attack or something bodily. That's, to me, I think, part of the reason. You also have a really disenfranchised population. Once someone has been labeled insane, especially in the 19th century, they had no rights. So you could easily kind of experiment on these people without any real repercussions. So I think those are a combination of the reasons why there's been such a kind of rank mistreatment of people with brain illnesses or mental illnesses.
Now, I said we'd talk about this idea of mental illness. You argue that it, as a catch-all term to describe all the different illnesses that people can suffer that maybe aren't corporeal in the sense of the body, you suggest that it's not the most useful term. I wondered why and what you think might be better.
I think it's very primitive. My hope is that 50 years from now, we'll think of something like mental illness as a relic. You know, we are learning so much about the interaction between the body and the brain and environment. We're at the cusp of really breaking this open. And in fact, I just read a really interesting book called The Angel and the Assassin by Donna Nakazawa, I believe her last name is. And it's an investigation of these immune cells in the brain called microglia. And not to get too specific here, but what was interesting to me there is that it was long believed that the brain was immune privileged, meaning the immune system had no effect on the brain. It couldn't get through the blood-brain barrier. But what we're finding now is that these microglia immune cells are all over the brain and have this diffuse effect. And those immune cells are not only just interacting with the body, but they're interacting with the environment too. So you realize that the brain is not at all distinct from those entities, and there's a very complex dance happening all the time among those three. In a way, you know, you can't extrapolate out what is mind, what is brain, what is body, what is environment. The more, I believe, science starts to investigate this, the greater the interaction there is. And so I think this idea that something is wholly mental will, I believe, become an outdated notion.
These kind of neuroscientific progress discussions I could have all afternoon. So I'll try and stick to kind of what's handled in the book more directly, what we can speak about with the kind of benefit of hindsight. And one of those things is this idea that, as you said, the label of madness, of hysteria, is a very good way of othering people. When you other someone, you kind of put them outside the parameters of normal human decent interactions, and you make them accessible to really coercive or really sadistic behaviours, but you also kind of get rid of them, don't you? I mean, you make the case that throughout much of the 19th and even the early 20th century, madness, hysteria, both of these were really useful kind of pseudo-medical social strictures, really, that were a good way of, for example, getting rid of an unwanted wife or getting rid of someone who might stand to get in the way of an inheritance or anything like this. Now, one hopes that we've moved on substantially since those days, but it made me reflect on this idea that madness is what society says it is. I wondered to what extent you see that use of madness as a kind of excuse at work in society today.
You know, it's so interesting because we are so bound in terms of what are social norms today. So it's hard to get outside that. But I think that you can look not too far into the past and see until 1980, homosexuality was considered a mental illness. And it seems absurd now to even say that. But this was part of the DSM, this was part of the bedrock of psychiatry, was that homosexuality was a mental disorder. So you think, what are the things that we're calling mental disorders now? Are they going to change in the future? You know, and of course, culture, technology, society, all these things create new problems, right? So it's not to say that these aren't moving targets and that new issues do crop up with new generations. But you do wonder, you know, what are we pathologizing that might be just normal behavior? I wish I could kind of rise above it and tell you this is going to be wrong in 20 years and that is going to be wrong. I cannot purport to kind of do that. But I can say that what was amazing to me in looking at the history is that you realize that these are man-made. And because they're man-made, they are prone to error. Medicine has errors. And, you know, we have to live with that understanding that it is a lot of times very much an art, not a science.
There's also this thing with mental health, which is that it does seem, as I started to say, it does seem unusually cultural. You know, you have these figures like R.D. Lang, who you talk about in the book, who is a Scottish psychoanalyst, I think, in the 60s and 70s, whose understanding of kind of counterculture heavily informed how he treated schizophrenic patients. Indeed, as you say, he almost came to see schizophrenia as a kind of super consciousness. I think what's odd about that is that no one in the modern age has ever considered, for example, paraplegia as a kind of highly advanced state of being. It's viewed as an unfortunate disability, one that you can live with, but one that maybe requires some treatment. I wondered what it is about mental health that kind of lends itself to this weird, weird system of romanticization, of kind of almost fetishism.
That is so interesting. And I think that there is some literature to back it up, that there is, you know, with creativity, oftentimes there are kind of proneness to more extreme behavior, more behavior outside the norm, sometimes mental illness. So you do have a kind of marrying of those two things. I mean, you always think about the creative genius, you think about Van Gogh, you know, cutting off his ear. These are part of the cultural ideas of what is a great artist. And I think that some of it is in reality. I think some of it's romanticized. But I also think that I've had personal experience with psychosis. It was the scariest, most terrifying thing to happen to me. The great majority of people who live with serious mental illness live with, you know, a lot of disability. You know, I bet you if you were to ask, I mean, I have asked a lot of people, they would not want to live with their mental illness, but that's not true. Some people do live full and meaningful lives with serious mental illness, and some believe that it's a gift of they can see the world in a different way. And I can say that having gone through psychosis, hallucinations, delusions, I would never want to live with that on a daily basis. It's completely immobilizing. But I did emerge from that experience a different person, and I think in some ways a more open-minded, more sympathetic. It changed me, and I think in some ways for the better. I think many people out there have had experiences with a kind of a foot on the outside of what is considered normal, you know, like a toe just right out in terms of, you know, maybe you've had a moment of depression, or maybe you've heard a voice, or there's a multitude of things that we've experienced that might be considered outside the norm. And I don't think it's all harmful. I don't think it's necessarily all destructive. And so I think that you can romanticize, but you have to keep in mind that there is a big portion of people, for example, living on the streets or in our jails and prisons, who are living with a form of serious mental illness that cannot be romanticized. It is disabling. It is destructive. And their life would be better off if they did not have that.
Thanks to Susanna Cahalan. And The Great Pretender is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. It's time for some new music now. This, from 3K in Wales' beautiful new EP 303, is Crooked Bank.
That was Crooked Bank by 3 Cane Whale. You're with The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Tom Edwards and Augustin Macellari in the chairs this week. Now, every now and then on The Weekly, you meet a fascinating character with whom you share something in common. Our next guest, in fact, shares my, one might almost say, masochistic enthusiasm for Tottenham Hotspur Football Club.
Tottenham Hotspurs, eh? The designer turned photographer Martin Anderson has produced a beautiful book of images drawn from the thousands he captured as he followed Spurs, or more accurately, the club's fans, in every saliva-flecked, beer-drenched detail over a number of seasons. The book Can't Smile Without You distills those images into a day in the life of the fans as the game and their club and its traditions embarked on a period of profound change. Oh, it got better, did it?
Not really. Martin joined me earlier to explain how a Dane turned lily white in 1978 and to reveal the lengths he had to go to embed himself with the Tottenham faithful. I began by asking him about the book's title.
First of all, I didn't want the book to be a football book as such. So I wanted it to be more kind of artistic, photographic book, but about football fans. And I thought of a kind of poetic title that would be interesting for most people. So for Tottenham fans, we all know that Can't Smile Without You is a song that we sing at the last home game of every season, written by...
Oh, it's not important who wrote it, is it? It's become, iconic now.
And I just felt it fitted really well to the kind of pictures I'm taking as well.
Now, one of the things that I really love about this book is that, precisely as you say, Martin, it is kind of about football. We can't escape that, but... It zeroes straight in on places like the Two Brewers just off the Tottenham High Road, which, again, Spurs fans will know and understand. But I haven't seen those places and what they sort of represent for the demographic that goes to games in a book before. And what's clever about it is it's not over-analytical. There's not loads of pontificating about why it's important. You just let the pictures speak for themselves. Why do you have such confidence that they are so... demonstrative, like just looking at the Two Brewers, where I must admit I've stopped going there now, I'm in my middle age, but it's a pretty unprepossessing building. Why so alluring for you?
I think that's what I found attractive. It doesn't really look like a pub, and it sort of look as a building. To me, that photograph could have been taken in 1930 or 1940. I did shoot in all the pubs around White Hart Lane, but that was the only building I thought was kind of, it was relevant for me as well, because I shot over 5 years. And I think when I first started, I've done many documentaries before. The last one I did was I spent 14 years taking pictures at dog shows. You've got a friendly audience there. It's really easy to take good pictures. I didn't quite know how to handle their football fans. So when I first started, to me, I'm a Tottenham fan, but I used to only go sort of 3 or 4 or 5 games a season. Then I became a season ticket holder. And I finished another project. One of my friends said, why don't you bring the camera along? So I started bringing the camera along, and I quickly found out the football fans don't like to have the picture taken. And over the first sort of 2 years, I got beaten up twice. And that made me more determined to kind of go, I really need to get this project done. I need to find out how to go about it. So I shaved my head and I kind of fitted more in. And I think after 2 years of shooting kind of the elderly and kids and kind of what was easily accessible, I found this place and it was really difficult. And I think for me, it had an important meaning to the project. That kind of when I found that place and I found that group of people and they allowed me in, it was sort of clear sailing to me. It was easy to take pictures from then on because I sort of got accepted. But it did take 3 or 4 years before I was sort of in with that. So
I don't mean this pejoratively at all, but what really, really struck me about the pictures is, especially of, a lot of these, how do we call some of these fans? They enjoy the football, of course. It's about camaraderie. They are pretty confident in themselves. I think they maybe might have been involved around those unsavoury instances that you were just describing about them not being happy that you've got your camera there. Football's not like it used to be in this country in the 80s where there was just violence everywhere. It was out of control. But it's almost sort of feral. And what you capture in these pictures, a lot of them, I had to kind of look for details to reassure myself that they weren't from 1980 or 1982. These are pictures that you've snapped recently, but the people look... like something from a different age. I don't know. Why do you think? Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. That's the beautiful thing about photography is that it is documentary photography, but I'm not photographing everybody. It's not random. To me, you do find, I look for interesting characters. I've never had an agenda, but I think all my work, I'm probably attracted to characters more than the average sort of football fan.
And why Tottenham then, Martin? You've mentioned that you're a fan. People can hear you're not necessarily from North London by the indication of your accent. What was it?
I've been here 30 years and I've still got that
accent. I can still hear it. What was it? Was it that team of that moment, I guess, in the 80s?
Do you know what? It was the first ever football game I was allowed to watch was the Argentina-Holland World Cup final, 78. And my parents allowed me to stay up to watch it. And I remember my mom said we should all support Holland because they're European. And I didn't have any of that. I was like the blue and white stripes and the confetti. And I was like, so I support Argentina. I then became completely hooked on football. As far as I remember, they mainly showed Tottenham, Liverpool, Everton at those at that time. And I think because Tottenham bought Adidas and Ricardo Villa straight after the World Cup, I just thought, I just seen them winning the World Cup. That's going to be my team. I didn't know it's going to be a lifelong life of misery. But,
Well, it's funny you say that. Has this sort of demonstrated to you this process of documenting the club that you've been following that actually it's not really about success or failure on the field. It's about something much more profound. And actually, the book's merits as a social history are as pronounced as its merits as a footballing history.
I've always been more interested in the time leading up to the game than the actual game. That's if I have to be 100% honest. To me, I love the kind of waking up in the morning, talking to your friends about the game, deciding what you're going to wear, going to the game. But it's those sort of 3-4 hours in the pub before the game, or the travelling on the train to a different city. That's exciting to me. That's I think it's the anticipation of the day or the game that's great. As soon as you start playing, it's
the wheels come off.
It has been good recently, hasn't it? But it's been
better than it's been.
There's been a lot of years in the
probably
sort of
about
80s,
the whole
90s,
time since you started following the club. Do you think that football fans and they're quite kind of committed football fans, the likes of which you document here,
are they
misunderstood by society? Do you think? Still now. I know we said that the age of sort of hooliganism is gone, the game's quite gentrified, it's very expensive to go, but are they still misunderstood by society?
I'm not really, I would say so. I'm not really sure what society think of them anymore. Most of those people in my book I would call friends now because I've known them for 5-7 years. Mm. To be honest, I haven't seen many problems. There's more problems in that book than there is at the average game because I've sorted out. And I think I've tried to document something that I don't know if it sounds bad, but that I sort of visually fell in love with growing up. And I think we're coming to a kind of new area of football, new stadium, different demographic of football fans that got own brewery, all that stuff. I'm not that keen on all that.
I was going to ask you about this because there's no question it was a bit scarier. I remember going as a kid in the probably a little bit later, sort of mid-80s when I started going a bit. And as a teenager, late in the sort of early 90s, or mid-90s, and it was still quite a scary place to go. It's got very febrile, sort of feral, super aggressive. Going to the new stadium now, I've taken my son there. He's only four. And it's like going to it's like going to a theme park. What do we risk losing, though, if it becomes too polished and with breweries, and it's like going to the theatre? What do we risk losing?
The worst thing is the ticket prices. To me, a sort of normal game against United Cities, that 70, 75 quid are the cheapest tickets, you know. So that means the working class can't go anymore. It's a bit like the gentrification of the city, I guess, isn't it? I mean, the people that used to go probably can't afford to go anymore. It does kind of change the way football is.
I guess some people will say to you, look, you have a very intuitive eye for capturing. You've already talked about how challenging it is to kind of get close enough to be able to document this. I wonder, I mean, I'm a fan of football, so it makes perfect sense to me. Does anyone ever say to you, oh, Martin, imagine what you could do if you tackled a proper subject? Do people ever say that to you?
Well, they haven't. No.
No, do you know what I mean? I don't think that. I just wonder, playing devil's advocate.
I would love to get that commission.
But what would that commission be? Would it be going to shoot, I don't know, would you go and shoot in Syria? Or
Yeah, I would. Yeah? I'm sort of, to me, I don't know, Syria, I've got two kids now, it's a bit dangerous. But I would like the chance of kind of going to Africa or to other places and shoot things. I'm learning to see myself as a photographer. It's very new to me. To me, I'm a graphic designer. I'm an animator, I make animation films for my sister, and I'm an academic, so I teach at three different universities. So the photography for me was always an escape route for not having clients. It was work that I did. I saved up from doing the commercial work to go and do my own little projects. So in that sense, I've never really seen myself.
So you've got an identity crisis as well, a little bit.
Well, I have, yeah. That's probably why it fits in so perfectly.
How do you follow? Will you keep documenting Tottenham, do you think?
No, I've stopped that. The last time I shot was at the last game of White Hart Lane. Mm. I can't go without my camera. I do bring my camera along, but I'm not aiming at kind of doing a new body of work about Tottenham.
And when you're at a game and you're not photographing it, do you think you experience it? I mean, there's practicalities about whether you can shoot people and you've got to be cautious, but do you think you experience the game differently, the occasion differently? Do you sort of flick into a different mindset almost?
Yes and no. I definitely enjoy the day. the thing is, everything is shot with a wide angle. I'm really up close and I'm kind of with that group of people. Mm. So the group, in most of those photographs, I will be with that group of people for quite a long time. So I'll talk to them during the day and they kind of know I'm there, so I'll be shooting away.
With this demographic, and you already talked about, you know, the two brewers, these little kind of social hubs and this difficult process really of beginning to belong.
Yeah.
Was there a sudden moment when that happened, or was it just familiarity or...
Familiarity. It took a bit of time to kind of get accepted in the different places, but also I sort of, I think, interestingly, about the kind of different places where people hang out before the games in the different pubs. They don't necessarily get on, which I thought was quite interesting. It kind of sums up people that they kind of, even though everybody supports Tottenham, they might not necessarily like the people that drink up in Bricklayers. So the guys from Troopers might not like the guys. I thought that's quite funny, but I think it sums up humans. You know, we like to create groups and we like to have enemies, even though we're sort of in the same group. As soon as we're on the pitch, kind of supporting the team, everybody supports the same team. As soon as we're out of there, there's still this kind of, oh, I don't like them.
Now, it's very funny. I mentioned actually just before we started recording that I immediately started going through this trying to find pictures of myself. I think that's the classic vanity of all people who from it. I found a couple of my pals in the Park Lane.
Did you ever see me photographing? I've been pretty camouflaged with a black camo and a black jacket.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask, maybe as a final thing, obviously those last couple of games at White Hart Lane, that season was amazing, undefeated at home. Incredible. It was extraordinary, a big win at the end. But on the road, do you have a game that you particularly, I don't know whether, it doesn't necessarily have to be the picture that you most like or the shot that you most like, but was there a game that you felt summed up the experience somehow, maybe better or more acutely than any other?
There was a few games when we beat City away. I can't remember what year it was when Eriksen scored in the sort of final minute and it was crazy. I saw men,
your fellow countrymen,
men crying, men crying next to me. To me, that was an incredible moment. Real Madrid at home, to me, beating them. I lost my dad. That was a quite big moment. I just finished shooting it. And so the first game against Arsenal after that, that was a big moment for me because we used to fly over for all the Arsenal games.
Really?
So I think that's probably the kind of, to me, but there's been so many fantastic games. And I think every time you go to a new stadium that you haven't been to before, that's always exciting to me.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that Tottenham carry on their conquests of new European stadiums.
Exactly.
We'll see how well that goes, Martin. Yeah. Where do you sit in the new stadium?
I'm in the wall.
Okay, yeah.
So I'm quite close to the top.
Are you a bit further out? So you're behind
row 78. So if anybody wants the picture taken.
Yeah. Well, I can't walk up that far. I tried to walk up there. I got vertigo. Yeah,
I know. It's.
I'm in row 12. Maybe we'll meet.
Halfway. Yeah, that's good.
But what about the old? Were you in the Park Lane in the old stadium?
Yeah.
Be honest. Obviously, the atmosphere is completely different, but the view's pretty good, isn't it?
Inside the stadium,
Does it capture some of the mood?
It is absolutely incredible. To me, you can't fault it. And I love the fact that it's built on the same ground. It feels like it is. And I think it's just, I need to get around the fact that, to me, but that's the way it is for everything. You always look back at the old as being kind of more better or whatever. I'm a hopeless romantic anyway, so that's where it goes. Do you mean?
And the brilliant book, Can't Smile Without You, is available in select art bookstores and other places.
Including his website.
That's the best place to get it. Head to shop.martinanderson.co.uk to pick up a copy. And who knows, Org, I, you or any of our listeners might see Martin in the environs of Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
I won't be seeing him around there.
You're with the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Now, it's voguish in the art world to make fat-headed statements. Some get made once, while others get made lots of times. One of the most popular, I think, is the sentiment that painting, that fundamental form of human expression that people have practiced since at least 40,000 years ago, is dead.
Now, while this might seem almost too ignorant to engage with, a new exhibition at the Whitechapel Gallery in London has successfully debunked it once again. Radical Figures, Painting in the New Millennium, presents paintings from the likes of Michael Armitage, Dana Schutz and Ryan Mosley, artists whose expressive works bring symbols, figures and images drawn from current events to tell stories and ask questions about the world around us.
I sat down with Ryan Mosley to find out more about the show and the artist's relationship to an art form that is most certainly not deceased. Seems like people are always declaring the death of painting. First it's cameras that are going to kill painting, then it's like something else, it's a tired form, and then it's not. It's a cycle. And I just feel like, is that narrative not a bit tired by now?
That as a narrative has been one thing that has been a constant the whole time. I've been a practitioner in painting, if you like. I remember when I first left school, and went to do like an NDQ at college. And it was primarily in fine art, but painting. I remember the tutor saying to us then, why?
Yeah.
Sort of, what are you doing? So that argument, in a way, it's been around, certainly for me, since sort of the mid-90s. And maybe at that point it was more obvious that there was less painting on the ground, but certainly over the last, I don't know, 20 years, and if not in the last 15 years since graduating from the Royal College, it seems like there's been a lot of painting, but maybe not figurative painting. That argument will always go on, and I think it's just because it's an easy thing to sort of put out there and start a catalyst for conversation. But I'd say definitely the last 10 years there's been way more figurative painting than there has been maybe in 25, 30 years. But at the same time, being immersed in painting and making figurative paintings, for me it's never really felt like it's even been an argument. You know, it's always been there. Maybe you had to look harder to find it, but it's always been there.
It seems like painters are always kind of having to deal with this. The first question is, as you say, why are you doing that? Why are you painting what you're painting? So before you can even start working on something, whatever it might be, you have to justify why you're doing it the way you're doing it. It just seems like the figure and painting are both about as fundamental as it gets in the kind of lizard brain of human expression. It seems weird that it isn't always bubbling under.
I think maybe it's to do with fashion and trends. Mm. And I think the longer I've spent in the art world, I've come to realise that maybe it has more in common with fashion, in the sense that partly to do with modernity, we're in a much faster paced life. Trends coming out of fashion much quicker. Maybe that's a market-driven thing, but figurative painting in the sense of a marketplace and art fairs and auctions, you only have to look in the last few years, and figurative painting's definitely been at the forefront compared to, say, abstract expressionist or gestural abstraction. And maybe that is the thing of, I don't want to sort of talk about the financial aspects of it, but maybe it's a safer bet because it has always been there. It has a longer history, it has a longer lineage. But yeah, I remember when I was leaving school and the careers advisor would come in and say, what is it you want to do? And I think at that point, I didn't realise you could be a painter or you could have a career as an artist even. She almost tried everything in her power to sort of dissuade me from doing this. But maybe because she had my best interest at heart. She's like, maybe you could be a candlestick maker or a baker. It was almost anything other than doing this. And that's probably because it wasn't a valid career choice. And maybe even now it's probably not a valid career choice. But certainly as a young person leaving school now, it probably is a more valid career choice. It's one of those things where I feel like I've done it for so long, I wouldn't know what else to do, and it's always been there. So yeah, figurative painting in the sense of the exhibition, I think they're sort of using the start of the new millennium, sort of 2000, as the anchor to build the exhibition on. But you know, some of those practitioners were making paintings before 2000, but there seems to be more of a spotlight on figuration since then.
And do you think, because you know, with these group shows, sometimes they're a bit cobbled together, aren't they? Do you think that this, we spoke about the kind of the outdated narrative or the tired narrative of painting as dead, quote unquote, a moment ago, but do you think that this narrative, this idea that there is a new movement in figurative painting as described in Radical Figures, which is the show, that like your work is kind of contiguous with the other artists that you're being exhibited beside?
Yeah, I mean, that thing of the generational thing, I think that was one thing that was brought up in a conversation yesterday. Is, you know, there is usually with these kind of group curated exhibitions, there is usually a tangible anchor point to start on. And in this show, that is figurative painting in a very broad sense. Sometimes it's a generational thing where the artists will have all been born in the same generation or sort of two decades. And I think probably around half the artists were born in the 80s, one or two in the 90s, and then you know the 70s and the 60s. So it's like a 50-year, five-decade expanse of when people were born and when they started making work. So in that sense, it has a longer overview of practitioners making work and practitioners making work when maybe figurative painting wasn't in vogue. So with radical painting as an exhibition, it doesn't feel cobbled together as much as some exhibitions because there is the overarching theme of figuration. I know recently, a few years ago, I was in a group painting show at the Saatchi Gallery called Painters Painters, and that was predominantly figurative painting. The difference there was that it was Charles Saatchi's private collection. So ultimately it was his taste rather than what was necessarily going on in the wider universe of painting.
When you look at the show as it's kind of been put together, is it quite uplifting? Is it a reassuring kind of survey of a movement or a part of a movement or just a discipline that you're a part of?
Again, for me, it's a real honour and privilege to be in the show because some of the other artists in the show who are slightly older, I've certainly been inspired by their work in the sense of when I was sort of 18 to 22, 23, they were some of the only few artists, figurative painters even, that you could see out there. Mm. But I think yeah, if you're going to the exhibition and maybe if you didn't know anything about contemporary art or figurative painting in the broadest sense, you're going to walk out of there, I think, feeling uplifted. What I said to someone yesterday is even if you don't like figurative painting, there's very little to not like about that exhibition. Like, colour is one thing so prevalent in the exhibition, just the use and power of colour, and then the portrayal of the figure. There's so much going on, and I think it feels like a really uplifting, powerful, and quite an honest show, in the sense of it is a survey of contemporary figurative painting. If I was a student now, if I went to see that show, I'd see that as a kind of a real sort of landmark moment in how you would then go on. How do you make art or figurative paintings at this point? And I think I wish there could kind of be more shows like this over the last 20 years, but maybe that comes back to that thing of fashion as well.
I'm glad you kind of touched on that then for the audience, because I think that there are, within this kind of thing that we've discussed, within this like complicated relationship that painting has to contemporary art, there's maybe a barrier when people come to look at it, I'm sure, to make paintings as well, where because it's such an old medium, because it's got such a history, it's almost difficult to look at. It's like, how are you meant to understand it? How are you meant to read it? And I wondered what your reflections are on that. When one looks at a painting, which is simultaneously a painting and contemporary art, uh-huh. rather than being decorative or rather than being a painting from art history, how does one engage with it? How do you engage with it?
I suppose if you look at painting or the possibilities of painting, not a lot's changed in maybe 2,000 years. Looking at early cave paintings, say in Lascaux, the attempt of sort of early man was to depict the human figure, whether that was to tell stories or whether that was to sort of have a discussion. And ultimately, it was storytelling, I guess. And I think not much has changed in two millennia. The paintings in this show all have some attempt of telling a story, whether that's a personal narrative or whether that's an art historical starting point, which the narrative is built from. How contemporary practitioners do you make contemporary art when you've got the whole canon of art history to sort of allow you to do that and also to stop you from doing that? Like, how do you compete with Goya or Velasquez or, you know, more contemporary practitioners like Peter Doig or Chris Ofili, who maybe were the other artists that were around in the 80s and 90s making figurative paintings? How, as a young person or, you know, a mid-career artist, do you compete with such a lineage of art history and storytelling? And I think that's the thing, narrative as a starting point pretty much for every artist in the show. We're all attempting to tell stories through paint.
This is it, and this is at the heart of the show. So, you know, when it comes to your work, you have this interest in the kind of carnivalesque in folk, and when it comes to putting a story into paint, is that how you're thinking? How does your research kind of translate into a painting?
Uh-huh. I mean, when I was at the Royal College, I remember when they announced, you know, you've got a dissertation to write.
Yeah.
It kind of struck the fear of God into me, because it was the first time in the sense of an academic subject, probably 12 or 13 years since leaving school, that I actually had to do any academic work in the sense of like a 20,000-word thesis, when you'd not done any writing of that sort of length for a long time. Mm. And I remember I kind of kicked against that initially. You know, I'm here to make paintings, not to sort of do the research or not to read. But actually, that was a very sort of, I think that was my sort of avoidance tactic. But what happened is, through looking at the art I was interested in and looking at the art history I was interested in and looking at the things I was interested in outside of art, it was storytelling, it was picture making, and it was, you know, looking at films and maybe looking at films that I would find a duality between a contemporary film and maybe a Greek tragedy. I was really interested in how stories and storytelling can have this cross-fertilization, or a story can be borrowed and reused and rehashed. And you might be looking at a Western, but actually it's based on a Greek tragedy or a fable or a moral tale. So that became something I was really interested in, how kind of European folk tales, if you like, could possibly be something I could pull from and feed back into the work, as much as going to the National Gallery and looking at paintings. I mean, when I worked at the National Gallery, that was another sort of starting point, in the sense I was looking at paintings and a protagonist in the painting would be portrayed, and I found that that character was maybe portrayed again and again and again. And these weren't religious paintings, it wasn't Christ, it was paintings that were made for the people in an attempt to tell a story. So I was fascinated in that, and in a way working there was as powerful an education as being at art school. So that's something that I've certainly, in my own practice, I've definitely pulled from that carnivalesque. And I was really interested in how certain European festivals and celebrations we had in the UK, but we had a different take on it, possibly. And I was interested in how that kind of provincial quality and how things could be slightly bastardised or changed through a filter of someone's interpretation at some point in history, changed that narrative slightly, and things were maybe slightly different or slightly wrong, and how that could be quite a powerful signifier to start an idea for a painting.
Mm. That's fascinating. To kind of go back to it again, as you say, painting is atavistic. It's like a part of the human creative experience of the mind. And like, in its earliest iterations, what was it if not a tool for storytelling? I don't know why it's become so divorced from that in the kind of contemporary consciousness where we're like looking at paintings and people are, I suppose what they don't have is linearity in some sense, but they do have the capacity to capture like an atmosphere or a quality of a story that opens something up in people's minds. And I suppose it, to me, has always wondered about how you communicate that potential to people and what your reflections are on that.
Well, I was talking to someone the other day about, as a child almost, you have none of the hang-ups that maybe you have when you're an adult or you're kind of going through the education system. You give a child a piece of paper and a pen or a piece of paper and a paintbrush, and the first thing they're probably going to paint is a face. Mm. They'll draw a face, and there'll be an attempt to draw something which is familiar to them. They see their reflection in a mirror, or they see themselves in a photograph, and it's what they can relate to. It's the first thing they see when they're born is their parents' face. So I think that's one thing. There's a kind of a purity and an essence and an immediacy, like you said. It's kind of a knee-jerk thing to do, to portray something that is familiar. And then you go through the education system, but also probably the art education system. And if you've got tutors or practitioners that have maybe had that purity sort of knocked out of them, in the sense that you can't, you know, again, it comes back to fashion. If they were studying in the 50s and 60s and 70s and painting wasn't in vogue and they had to kind of spend their time fighting against it, and or it just changed their way of making work, thinking about work and producing work. If you've gone through the education system and you have a tutor who really isn't a fan of painting, I mean, that happened to my wife.
It's game over, isn't
it? It's game over. We both went to the same art school to start with, and then when we went off to do our undergraduate, on her first day of art school, she went as a painter, and the first day that she was handed a video camera and a camera, and it was that thing was declared, painting's dead, why bother? So she's basically spent 3 years trying to make paintings with photography and video. It just seemed like, at the time, that was what happened at art schools, whereas now, certainly when I've gone back to art schools and given talks, or if I get asked to go in and do a presentation or just tutorials, I'm kind of shocked at how much painting's going on. In the sense of my interpretation would be these certain art schools, which I thought historically had not abolished painting, but painting was really thin on the ground. And I mean, you know, you go to an undergraduate where there's maybe 50 students, you might have four or five that were making paintings. Out of those four or five, maybe one or two are making figurative paintings. So it was that fashion thing, but maybe it was also seen as a quite twee to want to make paintings. Whereas now it feels like maybe I've kind of a reaction to technology and media as well. We all have the ability to take a photograph, to make a film on our phone, and probably a better quality than what you would with a video camera. It's more immediate as well. The platform's there to sort of, you could be a kind of a filmmaker and a photographer and be, I don't know, a banker almost. You could do anything. Whereas there's a humble quality to a paintbrush and a piece of paper. And maybe it's a slowing down thing as well. People, I think people are constantly talking about wanting to slow down, and there's nothing more of a kind of a slow pace than picturing something, whether that's a direct representation or whether it's a kind of a fictionalised motif of something.
My thanks to Ryan Mosley, and Radical Figures is open now at London's Whitechapel Gallery until the 10th of May. This is still just the Monocle Weekly.
Well, there you have it, Org. That is edition 554.
Nice for you to meet a fellow fan of Tottenham Hotspurs.
Can I listen, there's no S on the end of Hotspur. I know you're doing it to antagonise me. Martin, what a lovely man. It was interesting to me that he has published a book ostensibly about football that has no pictures of football, the game. It's an entirely social and cultural observation. As he was at pains to point out, it's a study of the people, all of the sort of infrastructure, all of these complex narratives that are woven together around the game. That 90 minutes is just the fulcrum on which all this interesting stuff pivots, which, and I've long attempted to explain that to people about my own interest in the game and its surroundings, and actually Martin's done a far better job than I've ever done.
Yes, and probably much less pretentious as well.
Yeah. And just in mainly imagery, there's a few bits of exposition in the book, but it's largely through the power of the pictures. It's a really interesting piece.
Do you think it will find fans with and in and amongst the fan base that it captures, sets out to capture?
Possibly. And what was quite striking was that Martin mentioned that fans even of other teams, including its enemy clubs like West Ham, Chelsea and Arsenal, have actually complimented him on the authenticity of what he's observed and captured. So I think that's pretty interesting.
I suspect only certain types of fan have probably complimented him on that.
Yeah, those that can go a step in communication beyond scratching their own name in the dirt with a stick. What about painting? Painting lives.
Painting lives. Painting's always lived. Painting is the most vital creative force. You've got infant children. Don't you see it?
And not in their artworks, especially not when they do them on the kitchen wall. I think we should wrap it up.
Let's do.
What a show it's been. Thanks to you for your role as the programme's producer. Thanks to our studio manager and editor, Maylee Evans. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye.
Thanks for tuning in.